And he would call me every 2 or 3 weeks to chat. At one point, I was like, "What do you want, dude? Like, why are you calling me? Like, are you a homosexual?" Like, that was legitimately my question. Like, why are you calling me so much? Like, what do you want? And he was like, "What do you mean? What do I want? I just care about you. I want to see how you're doing. How's school? How's life?" He ended up coming back that next year to the camp. My aunt again decided to pay for me to go, and I was playing varsity baseball. I broke my wrist, so that was gone for the summer. Is what I was going to do that summer. The best thing that's ever happened to me is breaking my wrist, and so I decided, I was like, well, I got nothing better to do. This guy's clearly already shown an interest in being friends and hanging out and stuff like that. So he was going and teaching the Bible, so I would go with him, and so I went from participating in zero Bible studies to going to 4 or 5 Bible studies a day. And a few months later, I remember I talked to my parents and I said, "Hey, so I've been reading the Bible and I think I'm going to get baptized and become a Christian." And my parents, my dad in particular, was like, what's this cult that you're, they're lying to you. You can't do that. I decided to do it anyways, a few days later. And there was some opposition for a good bit at first. Thank God that's not the case anymore. But that's a little bit about my background and really my conversion story. And so at the time, you would have a 75-year-old lady who made the decision to go to church. You would have a 20-year-old who invested in a 14-year-old, 15-year-old kid. And you had a lady who treated a kid like she was her own son, like he was her own son, even though he wasn't, and he had a mom, but she made the effort to love him like she was his own kid. And so three very different people in very different places and stages in life all played a role in my conversion. Then you had people like Gardner Hall, one of the evangelists up there again, who just gave rides all the time. And maybe part of why I say that is because I think sometimes it's easy to think evangelism is Josh's role or Steve's role or the role of one or two people. At least in my life, evangelism was shown through a lot of people and a lot of people doing a lot of different things. And I thank God for that.
I think that's a really, powerful story there, because like you just said, while all of us need to, get comfortable with the story of the gospel and at least be able to share, why our hope is in Jesus and what that hope means, yet evangelism isn't just the part where, okay, we're going to sit down with the Bible and we're going to have the Bible study now. There's mm-hmm. so much more involved and so many roles in that.
Absolutely.
So that actually kind of brings me to my second question then. So you've been at Embry Hills how long now?
A little over 6 years.
Okay, a little over 6 years at Embry Hills. I've never visited there, but I know people that have visited there, and they talk about the culture and how you guys even treat visitors and everything else like that. So if you're looking at the work there, and like you just said, not putting the work of evangelism on a select few, how is it that Embry Hills has embraced the culture of evangelism? How have the shepherds at Embry Hills helped to establish that culture of evangelism? What does that culture even look like at Embry Hills? That may be a whole lot in one question, so just feel free to go whatever direction you want to.
No, that's good. That's good. So, that's a weird question for me to think about. Like, I'll be honest, even when I kind of thought about that idea and just the culture of Embry Hills, but yeah, I mean, so the culture of Embry Hills, I would say for the most part, and no church is perfect. Embry Hills has flaws, but one of its strengths, I think, are that we have a culture where people think about the souls of other people, particularly visitors, non-Christians, and how to help and serve them. In a lot of ways, some churches are shaped by their evangelists, for whatever the case may be. Like you have an evangelist who just kind of shines. And so the culture of the group of believers tend to follow after that person. Embry Hills, in a lot of ways, they follow the lead of the elders. And that's a good and a healthy thing. We've been blessed by having elders who are evangelistic. It's just, honestly, I didn't come in here, and none of the evangelists who've come here to the last 10, 15, 20 years have really shaped the culture. The elders were the ones who shaped this culture of evangelism by evangelizing. It helps. whenever one of your elders is also an evangelist. So Sewell, you know, moved here a number of years ago, and I think he definitely played a big role in that. But I think even right now, our seven current elders, we have one elder who consistently teaches a meetup study. We have another elder. It's actually like, well, he's never going to watch this, so it's whatever. But Christina's dad, so my father-in-law, like, was having strangers and his neighbors opened up his home to have people over for a Bible study on Tuesday nights, and then opens up his home on Friday mornings so that one of our other evangelists can have a study at the house and invite people to that. I mean, I think in a lot of ways, I think we think if we just bring in the right guy, the right evangelist, the body will follow suit. But I think in a lot of ways, sheep follow the shepherd, they're shepherds. And if you have shepherds who are leading the sheep to evangelize, you'll end up having a body of believers who will evangelize. And so I've been blessed to come into a situation that was already doing that. I'll be honest, I didn't, you know, me and Ben Hall, who I think a lot of you know, Ben was here before I was, and David Maxson was here before Ben. I mean, just, I don't think any one of us really shaped the culture of evangelism here. I think the elders saw the need, the elders were doing it, and the evangelists were brought in to spend more time doing that, but not to do that specifically. And so I keep saying that because, again, in a lot of ways, evangelism is something that everybody has to play a role in, regardless of your age, regardless of your biblical knowledge, regardless of your talents, you offer something in evangelism. And I think it's helpful to see that and to know that.
How has, because I'm sure this is something that, you know, the eldership there has, you know, grown in over the years and have helped, you know, kind of change the culture, you know, which happens over time. You know, you don't just, you know, say, all right, here's the culture, we're starting this, this is what it is today. Can you even, you know, track what has changed in the 6 years that you've been there?
So it's really cool. So, all right, so this is good. So last 6 years I've been here, Embry Hills, what I've noticed, at least with our elders, is there's a willingness to scripturally do whatever they can do to make the gospel available, readily available to the people in the community. I think we have to realize that wherever it is your church is, so, you know, university, you're in a certain community. I think, like, what are you doing to make the gospel available to the people across the street and two blocks away and three blocks away? So here's part of why I say that. So Embry Hills, when I came here, was a church of 400. It was an English-speaking church. So Spanish is my native language. I'm Hispanic. And about 4 years ago, some things happened, and the elders came to me and said, like, this was not my initiative. They came to me and said, hey, there are some souls who speak Spanish. We're in a Spanish-speaking neighborhood. Would you be willing to do some things in Spanish for us? I said, okay. And it's hard, but we've had, I thank God. I mean, we've had anywhere between 20 and 30 Spanish speaking people who worship with us regularly. This year alone, we've had 4 baptisms of Spanish speaking people. I'm not sure that all happens if we don't have elders who are willing to kind of get past their comfort zones and say, you know what, we're going to bring people in who don't speak the same language as us, and we're going to do whatever it is that we can do to make sure that worship is available to them, and Bible studies are available to them. And you know, we do in-person translating. Well, one of our elders paid to get all the audio equipment out of his own pockets to see if it would work. We have another elder who used to teach a Friday night class in bilingual with some of these members, whether I was there or not. I mean, we just had a number of people who I think even in the last 6 years, we've had elders who are willing to go through growing pains and do things that are uncomfortable, do things that are different, scripturally sound, but different, to reach people that maybe they would have thought they couldn't have reached before.
That's really encouraging to hear. Well, let's talk about just the last year. And that was, you know, super encouraging to even hear, you know, about the 4 Spanish speaking baptisms. So the past year has had, you know, its own challenges, you know, primarily, you know, the pandemic, you know, churches shutting down, then churches getting back to, you know, kind of getting back to some kind of normalcy. And then, of course, you've got, everything else. You've got societal issues that are flaring up. You've got election issues. You're in Georgia, so you've still got election issues. What have been both the challenges and the successes that you guys have experienced in that time?
Yeah, so I think the challenges, and you like you just mentioned, we're in Georgia, but you could say the same thing about any state. I think part of the challenges are that we live with people. You know, the challenge and the success come from the same, like are found in the same thing. The challenge is that you deal with people. The successes are whenever people stay the course on Christ and have their minds where they need to be. But the challenges have been there. Politically, we worship with people who are on both ends of the extreme. Our elders do a good job at, and I think there's a buy-in from the body. But I think this starts up top. You have the elders, you have the evangelists, deacons, everybody. There's a buy-in that when we're together, none of that actually matters. But there have been political challenges, and you can kind of tell in conversations, you can tell in things that people want to say, things that people want to talk about in the past, at least not within the body, but there'd be a temptation, you would think, where for people to bring up one thing, you know, this side, nor this side, where we've got to get this thing done. I think especially last year with COVID, because politics have always been around, and whether we want to admit it or not, racial issues have always been around. COVID has been a little bit different, and it was a big challenge, and there was a lot of fear, a lot of things that are brought up to the forefront of people's minds that maybe people weren't thinking about before. They presented different challenges, and so I think some of the challenges they presented was there was a physical separation that you had to overcome. Then there's also a emotional separation that I think 2020 created in people. Just again, because of the politics, because of the way people view COVID, because of the way that people view race, there was always kind of this, do you actually care? What's your angle? What's your take? What's your this or that? Those challenges existed. I would like to think that as a whole, now this isn't true of every single person who's worshiped with us and or everybody in the body, but I would like to think that as a whole, we've had a people who understood that our alliance primarily is to the Lord, not even to Embry Hills, just to the Lord, first and foremost. And so whenever social issues came up, we can talk about some of those issues, but understand that our image is found in God. Whenever politics issues came up, well, maybe we can talk about some of those issues, but we understand we had lessons on those things. Our elders talked about it. Emails were sent out. Conversations were had between individuals. We can do those things, but we understand the real party we belong to. You know, as we think about COVID and even the separation and all of that, and whether you're doing something online and Zoom classes online and things online, like you can be separate, but 1 Corinthians 12, you remember the body that you belong to. And so, and part of why that's important is y'all encountered the same issues. That was 2020. And who knows, 2024, there may be some completely different, unexpected issues that'll come up. The success, the answer is still found in the same source. It's found in the gospel. It's found in being a part of the body of Christ. Not that the body itself is what's saving people, but being in Christ and receiving that mutual encouragement, that mutual love, that mutual uplifting in one another, I think was especially helpful for us this past year. And so there were some unfortunate, you know, things that happened, but for the most part, I think that the body sought and took to grow with one another and to make sure that no one was being left behind and that we were trying to be one in the Lord.
You know, that's really one of my hopes that is kind of the takeaway from these challenging times is that we have been reminded that, you know, of something that maybe we're not as cognizant of in the good times, and that is the centrality of Christ and that this is what has to shine forth. This is what we're about. And maybe it took a really difficult year to help us to be reminded of that. And maybe we can carry that forward more than we did in the past.
Which as if you don't mind my just kind of shifting gears a little bit, but not
don't
very
mind
much.
At all.
Okay. But so it makes me think, you know, in 2 Corinthians, just as even as Paul opens up the letter, he talks about God comforting us in our affliction so that we can comfort other people. I think if anything, 2020 was a really good year for evangelism, at least for evangelistic opportunities. People were at home a lot more than they usually were. There's something about whenever you're by yourself that you contemplate your mortality. Maybe you don't, but like a lot of people do. A lot of people, whenever they're not so busy with life, think about where is my life going? I had a number of studies last year that just came up from people being at home and not having anything to do. And then kind of wondering what's really going on in my life. And again, I don't say that flippantly, like the afflictions that occurred. But the comfort, if you're a Christian, that the Lord offered you is different than what the rest of the world had. We all suffered in some of the same ways last year, whether that's because of your political beliefs, because of it's your skin complexion or health-wise. Everybody suffered in some way last year. But the comfort that God gives you is different than what everybody else has. And so because you don't respond the way that everybody else responded, I think about opportunities I had with members of my family this past year to spend time in the Word. It's because we would talk about these issues and I wasn't despairing the way that they were despairing, solely because my hope was in something else. And so I think that if you think about some of those things, that like those have been opportunities that maybe were unexpected. But really, as you think about the gospel, you think about the book of Acts, that's really the way the Lord has worked, is he takes famine and here are Christians being different. You take Acts chapter 6 and there's widows that aren't being taken care of, and the chapter ends and people are obeying the gospel. Well, here's a problem, and from that problem people obeyed the gospel. You know, you have the leaders of this, the way, they're being persecuted in chapters 3 and 4, and people are obeying the gospel. Stephen gets killed, the Christians get scattered, and Christians are obeying the gospel. What's that about? I wonder if part of that, as these Christians are going through all these afflictions, they're going through these afflictions, but their hope isn't going anywhere. And so because their hope isn't going anywhere, you just imagine they meet somebody else and you know, they're like, well, why are you here? It's like, well, I got ran out of Jerusalem because this guy named Saul of Tarsus, of all places, he kicked me out of town. But and why'd that happen? Well, because I'm a Christian and I believe in the gospel. Like, you see what I'm saying? It's like, I think Christians are so atypical in that we suffer like everybody else, but we handle it differently. We should at least handle it differently because of the hope that we have in the Lord.
Yeah, you look at church history, and the worst thing that ever happened to the church was it became acceptable in society.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe, you know, as much as we wring our hands about the kind of really seismic changes in our world, and you know, as a father and you as a father, you know, no doubt those things raise concerns for me. You know, I'm concerned about, you know, things my kids have to face that, you know, I didn't have to face, didn't have to worry about. But there is opportunity for the gospel there. When it's darker out, the light shines brighter. Mm-hmm. And praise God, you know, that you know, you were able to have, you know, the success you had in those times. All right. So I'm coming to my last question. So I'm putting that out there for any of our members that you, if you want to submit a question on the chat, or if you want to, well, there's one, so we'll get to that in a minute, or you can raise your hand and I'll peruse this and come to you here in a minute. This is, and again, I've never been to Embry Hills, so I'm kind of going off of kind of what I know about it. But Embry-Hills is similar to university in that while you're not, it's not a, you know, it's a diverse group, but probably the majority are white members. But likewise, your aim is to share the gospel with everyone around you. And, you know, I'm mindful, you know, you mentioned Paul in 2 Corinthians. I'll go back to 1 Corinthians where in chapter 9, you know, he makes the whole point of, to the Jews, I became as a Jew that I might win Jews, to those who are under the law as under the law, that not being under the law of myself. And he goes on to talk about, you know, how he became all things to all men. What would you say in our culture? And again, all the things we've got going on around us, you know, I'm not going to necessarily change what I am. And yet I still want to reach out to others who are different than me. Uh-huh. How is it that we as individuals, what is it that we as even, you know, as churches need to be thinking about as far as what it means to become all things to all people in these times?
Yeah. So I always think that's interesting, right? Because he talks about becoming all things to all people. And in the context in chapters 8 and 10, he's saying, don't go and participate in this worship. you know? And so what he's not saying in becoming all things to all people is literally become what they become. Because again, contextually, he's saying don't do these things. But I think there is a sense where like your traditions, your customs, the things that your culture come second to the gospel. And there's, I think oftentimes there's a temptation to want to make people the way you are before you make them before you try to convert them to the Lord. And that's just not the image. So that's maybe like an aside thing that I think about oftentimes, like, you don't have to cut your hair bald and grow facial hair to be a Christian. I'm a Christian who happens to look that way, but you don't have to do that. It's been interesting to me that the thought that, like, for example, in Ephesians 3 and in Galatians 2, Paul talks about how the Lord has used him to go to the Gentiles. And he talks about Peter and James, them going to the Jews. I guess what's weird to me about that is that Paul, who would have had the Pharisaical background, might have been more useful, at least in my thinking. Like, logically, this is what the Lord, like, Paul, you should go to the Jews. And Peter, who's a fisherman, you know, like, and he had the whole thing with Cornelius, have him go to the Gentiles. And it's almost like what the Lord does is he flips that and he reverses that. And he says, no, Paul, you're going to go to the Gentiles. And Peter, you're going to go to the Jews. And maybe part of the idea is, as far as like culturally what that looks like, what it doesn't look like, is like treat people as souls who need the gospel. I think it's easy to want to go through some of the challenges that maybe Paul deals with in the book of Galatians, where Christians are trying to Judaize the Gentiles before you make them Christians. I think sometimes we want to either Americanize or whatever your culture is to make them like our culture before we make them Christians. And that's not what the gospel calls you to do. The gospel calls you to talk to people about the Lord and to convert people to the Lord. Like that's our aim. That's our hope. And so, you know, I think about like even the studies that I have, if I had to, like, I've never really sit down and think, well, what are the kinds of people that I study with? But I study with white people. I study with Black people. I study with Mexicans. I study with Guatemalans. I study with people from Colombia. I study, you know, there. But in my mind, I study with people, you know? And if I studied with 30 white people this week, I don't feel bad that I studied with 30 white people, because those are 30 souls that need the Lord. If I studied with 30 Black people, I don't feel bad that I studied with 30 Black people, because there's 30 souls that needed the Lord. Now, if I study with 30 white people and somehow I take pride in that, or if I study with 30 Black people and somehow I take pride in that, then there's an issue. You see what I'm saying? Like, I was kind of play that, like, as a person of color, I think sometimes we put too much emphasis onto that. Like, preach the gospel to people, and that the gospel will do what it's supposed to do, regardless of the person's skin complexion, regardless of their political beliefs, regardless of their background. Our job, our role, is to talk about the good news. So that's my two cents on that, I guess.
I mean, amen. better than half of the New Testament letters are written about that issue. It's about Jew and Gentile being one in the gospel, being one in the church. And this is where the wisdom and the mystery of God is revealed. You know, this is... We're not dealing with a new issue. We're dealing with the same issue that they were dealing with in the first century. And you're absolutely right. What's going on there was, whatever Christian you are, reach out to people. You know, it doesn't matter what your background is and what their background is, you reach out to people. And that's you doing the job.
And again, so you're reaching out to whatever your community is. It happens to be right now that the community around Embry Hills is predominantly Spanish. And so that's not going to be a surprise that we end up having some Spanish visitors. But we're not we have to look for these kinds of people, or we have to look for those kinds of people. You have to look for souls.
Yeah.
Everybody's got one. So whoever's around you, that's who you've got to look for.
All right, I've got two practical questions here from one of our deacons. So I'll go ahead and start with these. And then again, anyone feel free to chime in. First one, when I visited Embry Hills, it was a very warm welcome and many members helped with taking the kids to class, seating us, introducing us to others. Is this structured? If so, what is Embry Hills doing to make the guests feel welcome?
Y'all are really asking the wrong person.
I asked the wrong person to do this talk.
So, yeah, you did. Surprise. I'm sure it's structured. I'm sure it's structured. But I mean, there's been so many conversations had with like between people with one another, where we just know, like, this is just, it's a mind. It's more than a structure. It's a mindset where people just know, like, this is what we do. If you see a face that you haven't seen before, go talk to that face. If you, you know, instead of like, oh, I don't know who they are, I'm going to avoid them. No, if you haven't talked to this person before, go talk to them. You might realize, actually, this happens sometime. They're a member and you didn't know they were a member, and then kind of like shame on both of you. But if they're a visitor, great. And go talk to, you know, see what's going on, see what, but we do have, well, pre-COVID, we had kind of work groups. And so we had like a members work group and a visitors work group, where we had a group of 30 people, 30, 40 people who for that month, they were almost like more focused on the visitors. And so services are done, or before services, they were the greeters. And then as soon as services were done, they were especially looking for visitors. So I'm not going to talk to my friends, even though I want to. I'm not going to go talk to my cousin who worships with me, even though I want to. I'm going to go look for somebody I don't know. And then afterwards, we would typically have, I would be in those meetings. One of the evangelists would be in those meetings. And then we would have a conversation about the visitors that we saw and kind of keeping them in mind and reaching out to them throughout the week and all of that. And so there is structure to it. But I would say that with the structure, or maybe in the underlying thing behind that structure, is a mindset that if you see somebody, and so this is something you can do like this Sunday or this upcoming Sunday, I guess today's pretty much done, but this upcoming Sunday, if you see somebody you don't know, next time you go to worship, go talk to them, ask them where they're from, what's going on, you know, why, you know, we're glad you're with us today. What kind of inspired that? How can we help you after we're done here? Would you be interested? Let me tell you about all these other things we actually do outside of this class. Let me connect you with these other people as well. But we have some people who are superstars here about that. One of our deacons, Cedric McCollins, he'll talk to a cutout person if like that person was standing. He didn't care who it is. He's going to talk to whoever he sees, and he's great. But like he's super warm. He's super sweet. And we need people like that. And we don't have 500 Cedrics, but we have a Cedric, and we have a few other people who we have a young lady named Anna Lee, and she will. Annalie Peak will talk to everybody and invite anybody out to lunch after services and say, you want to just grab, a few of us are grabbing lunch, you want to come with us? And I mean, like, that it's, again, it's that mindset that's going to make people feel welcome.
All right, another question. And if you don't have the answer to this, tell me who I do need to talk to at Embry Hills. I mean, I'd really like to interview that person.
Yeah.
Now, this question, so you mentioned a lot about how the elders are heavily involved and highly motivated in evangelism. If I'm a motivated member, what can I as an individual do to help reach the lost? How has Embry Hills helped the individual member to be engaged in the work of saving the lost?
All right. So you probably should still go talk to somebody else, but I do have some thoughts on this. So as an individual member, what you can do we also have evangelism deacons, and like our evangelism deacons should probably be evangelists elsewhere. But one of the guys, Dave Hamlet, who actually used to preach in Canada and now he worships with us, he's great about setting people up. So if you go to him and you're like, hey, I want to be more involved, what should I do? Like he'll have a list of things that you could do to be more involved in. And that is either you can join a study that someone else is already doing. Because here's the thing. So let's say you're a motivated member, but you lack the skills, which is a real thing. Like there's no knock in that. The heart matters a whole lot more than whatever talents or abilities you think you have. But let's say you're super motivated and you're just like, I don't know how to do this very well. In fact, I don't know how to have a conversation with a stranger. I've never really done that. And so I want to figure out how to do this. What you could do is you could join a study where there are strangers and you look at how the other people in those studies are involved with that and are a part of that. And so I think that what Embry Hills has done is that Embry Hills has like, we've done different things. We've tried different things in the past. Some things have worked, some things haven't. We've done these like studies for 4 weeks where we have a host family and then a few members who get a part, who end up being a part of it, and then select teachers. Now the evangelists prepare the material, but they're typically not teaching it. It's like everybody else is a part of it. So we've had things like that. But to me, it's more organic than that. So there's a young man who I actually think he has family that worships at university. There's a young guy named, I say young guy, he's in his 30s, but his name is Luke Pfizer. Luke right now is doing some he preaches every now and then. He and I do what we co-teach on Thursday nights, and he invites his coworkers. He invites people he plays basketball with. He invites, I mean, just a ton of people. He and I were actually talking about a week ago about just where he felt like he was at a few years ago versus where he's at now. Now, that's not me in particular. He and I are very close, but he's also close with Ben. His wife's also, like, he ended up getting married to the sweet young lady. She's great. What ends up happening is that he just surrounded himself with people who were doing it. And where in the past he would have said, I'm not sure if I have the heart and I'm not sure how to do it. He cultivated both, really. And now he's actively looking for people to study with, and he's studying. And sometimes, you know, he'll call me, he'll say, hey, I'm wanting to talk about this question or about this subject. What's the process? What do I do? Part of why I say all of that is to say, like, you may feel like you don't have the heart. You can cultivate that heart, or you may feel like you don't have the skills, but you have the heart, you have the motivation. You can have that as well. And I think part of that, again, is by going to people who are currently involved in that work and just asking them to be a part of it.
How many, and I know pre-COVID, you could even find it on the website, maybe you have it on the website now, but y'all had just numerous weekday studies, you know, group studies that, you know, members could be involved in. How many of y'all of those do y'all have going right now?
I wish I had the actual number.
But I wish I talked to the right person again.
But I am sure that every night of the week, except for Saturday night, there is some group study that somebody can join. And so, and not all of those are taught by our evangelists. In fact, we have Atlanta so big, we have different studies being taught by different people in different places. Some of those are on Zoom. Some of those are in person. But we'll have one study in North Atlanta, one study on the west side, one study on the east side. And they're done by different people. But as far as an actual number, I don't have an exact number. But what I can say definitively is that we have more studies than I know. I can definitively say that. A number of the people who are involved in that aren't elders or deacons or evangelists. They're Christians.
Yeah. A couple more questions here. Here's one from one of our elders. There is more than one evangelist at Embry Hills. What is the typical week for you as an evangelist there? I don't know why they're asking this question unless they're like doing some kind of performance review on me right now. So it
depends. Because there are three, four really. Sewell says he's not an evangelist anymore, but his work proves otherwise. So we have four. We have four evangelists. And truth be told, we have four evangelists plus two elders who preach semi-regularly. So Embry Hills is weird in that if you think you're going to be here and preach four times a month or five, six times a month, you're going to be really bored throughout the week. And so with so many evangelists, what that ends up doing with so many evangelists and really elders who are willing to preach and members, we have a ton of members, again, who I believe we have multiple members who are, this is Bill speaking here, personal feelings. Our best evangelist is not an evangelist or an elder or a deacon. So, and whenever he preaches in my mind, I'm like, this is better than everybody else here. But what that does is that it frees us to spend time studying with people, and it frees us to reach out, which, by the way, evangelism isn't just like here are lost souls. I think especially with COVID, we have found, and I think Philip, one of our evangelists, has been great about this, is thinking like evangelizing within the body. Because what ended up happening last year is for all the good that happened, you ended up having people who allowed the world to sever them from Christ. And bringing people back who have drifted away back to the world like that, that's evangelism as well. It's not just here's a cold contact or here's someone who's never known about God. It's the member who is falling away, the member who's discouraged. Evangelizing is saying good things. It's good news, bringing the good message. And so there's doing that. But as far as my personal week, I try to think about it. I'm back to, so the baby stop things more than COVID did for me. But I'm back to about 15 to 20, 25 studies a week. And that's spread out throughout the different days. And it's, some of those are in Spanish. Some of those are in English. Some of those are with, like, some of those are, we have a member who's dating a girl and she's not a Christian. And eventually she asked him, you know, she said, "Hey, you're weird about politics in that you never talk about it. Is everybody in your church like that? What does the Bible say about that sort of stuff?" I've been studying with this guy and his girlfriend for the last month and a half. Some of it, we have a lady who, her name's Rosie, and she's like kind of crazy, but my favorite person. I've generated more studies because of her than I have personally on my own, because she will call anybody and everybody and say, "Hey, you want to have a Bible study with this guy named Bill?" And some people say yes. And so we study with them, you know? And so I have, there's four studies that I teach that she's a part of, either that she has started or she is there. And again, she got baptized 3-4 years ago. And here she is just bringing everybody she can find to the Lord. But yeah, so some of my studies are with our high school kids. Some of my studies are with non-Christians. Some of my studies are with Christians who are wanting to, I want to learn how to teach. And so what we do sometimes, like there's a young guy I study with who, I say young guy again, he's in his mid twenties, but what we do is we go through a book and I'll teach the first half of the book. But as I'm teaching the book, I'm giving him the breakdown of the book. I'm kind of giving him how to, not just so much how to, like, here's information to digest, but here is how I break down as I'm reading on my own so that you can read it on your own. And then you can talk to people about it as well. And so then the second half of the book, he has to teach me. Because I've found if you can teach somebody else, if you can teach the person who's teaching you, you're going to be fine teaching anybody else. And so, we've done that with a few different people and, I found some success in that, but so that's kind of what my week typically looks like. And then, you know, there's a lot of diapers throughout the week. There's rocking, crying baby. So that's a part of the week as well, but there's also cuddles with a cute baby, laughs and giggles. So I don't want to act like that's not a part of my week these days. It is.
So this question is actually, I'm going to go ahead and throw it in with what you were just talking about, because you're talking about all the studies you have. The diapers. How many of your contacts are, you know, from other members, or are there, is the congregation, you know, itself doing things to drive contacts, advertising to get contacts in that way?
So most of our studies are from members reaching out to other people, which I'm super thankful for, actually, because it means that our members are doing something. But the majority.
Plus, that's your better contact anyway, because they already have an intro to the group.
Yeah. Some contacts have been through like a meetup. You set something up on meetup and people are looking for something. Sometimes whenever you do that, they'll come for a few times and then they're kind of like, I wasn't feeling this, although keep it open. And if they come again, great. And if somebody else comes, great. So most of our contacts, at least personally, most of my contacts probably come from other members. One of our other evangelists, he'll probably say that most of his contacts have come from meetup, although some of them have come through other members. So meetup is probably the as far as reaching out to people, one of the better ways we've done advertising. So we have some Facebook, like some social media presence, but it's not as great as we probably feel like it should be. The sign in front of the building is not really doing much, but mm-hmm. Meetup, I mean, we are pretty active on meetup, and we do have people who are pretty active in talking to other people, talking to their neighbors and saying, again, which is just different, because you can just say, "Hey, I'm doing this study." You don't even have to go anywhere. In fact, you can stay at home and be a part of it. You want to come one time? And some people have come and they've stayed.
Wow. I got a couple more really good questions here. Here's another one from one of our deacons. You mentioned when you became a Christian that your parents viewed it as cultish. With their worldviews, what aspects of Christianity did they view as being a cult, and how did you and they overcome it?
So all of it. I'm not joking. So my parents my dad has passed away, my mom is alive. My parents were were what I would call practicing atheists, in that, you can say you believe in God, but don't really do anything about it. And, we were raised that the only thing that you really devote yourself to is your education. And so you giving yourself to anything else is a cult. You know, I could remember being in high school, and in hindsight, my mom would feel differently about it today than she did 15 years ago, 14 years ago. But I could remember being in high school, and it was the summertime, and I was reading Exodus in the living room. And she was like, "What are you doing? Like, look, it's okay to read every now and then, but don't be a fanatic." And like, that was just the mentality is, listen, it's okay to do this every now and then. Like, you don't have to go to church every Sunday, every Tuesday, every Thursday. Part of overcoming that was making sure that I was fulfilling my other responsibilities while being a Christian. And so their big fear was, you're going to church too much. You better make sure your studies aren't failing. And so you have so much time. Sacrifices were made. So I stopped playing baseball. I love the sport of baseball. I'm not a Yankees fan. That'd be crazy. But you know, you make sacrifices. I know I saw the Yankee shirt and I was like, what is this?
Poor Emily.
That's terrible. It's like, I've got, okay. But it was making sacrifices like that. And I would say this, you stay committed enough that they start to see. And I think part of it is that maybe my parents thought this is just a phase you're going through. You're weird. You're in high school. You're changing. You don't know what you want. Like, this is just a phase. This isn't real to you right now. And I think they see that that's not the case. I, as a kid, I can remember like being stubborn and I'm not conceding. I'm going to church. I'd rather not go to a family gathering because I'm going to services. Thanksgiving. So we used to have Bible class on Thursdays. I wouldn't go to Thanksgiving. I'd go to Bible class instead of going to Thanksgiving with my family. And a part of that, you know, I think they took it as like, well, this kind of seems a little bit cultish. But then what they also started to see, a little bit later than probably they should have, and that's on me, but they started to see a change. A guy who didn't talk the way that he used to talk and didn't use his time the way that he used his time and served not to get anything and cared about older people that weren't related to him. And, you know, that's how they overcame it, is they understood that, like, I mean, the truth is, and I don't want to sound weird or anything, but Christianity is a cult. Where Jesus Christ is the person that we're fanatics of. Like, I'm not a cult over some pastor, over some person, like, but it's Jesus Christ. I'm a fanatic for him. And I will always be that. I don't shy away from that. Again, like, the way you overcome that, at least in my family, is by being the person the Bible calls you to be. And then they're like, oh, wait, this actually isn't a crazy thing. You're behaving the way that I wish I did. Yeah.
All right. How do you create an evangelism culture with teens and college age people? Is it different than other groups?
No, to me, it's not different because teens are not like, first of all, whenever someone's in college, they're an adult. So you'll get treated like everybody else. But even with our high school kids, I here's the thing. I think that we treat high schoolers like they're in elementary school. And they're dealing with adult issues and they're dealing with adult questions and they're dealing with adult things. But because they get treated like little kids, they never verbalize any of their adult issues. And so then you end up having a group of people who are dealing with adult issues, have had parents who kind of do everything for them, and they end up being out on their own and they struggle. I think that has been a trend, not so much at I wouldn't even necessarily say so much at Embry Hills, but like that I've seen as a young person with other young people my age. What we try to do, though, with the young people is same thing. Hey, invite your friends to a Bible study with the young boys in particular. So what I was mentioning that I do with this young guy, I do it with a few of our high schoolers as well, that we get together and we study. And I'll tell them, pick a book that you feel comfortable with. And they'll pick a book. And the first few studies is I'm breaking down the book. I'm kind of showing them some things to keep in mind, some themes as they go throughout the book. And then I say, OK, week to week, you're going to prep and you're going to teach me. And we go through some of that. And I teach a high school study every other Saturday at one of our members' house, one of our deacons' homes. And, you know, last year, and the problem was we had three seniors who graduated, but last year, at a point where I didn't teach the last 8 months because we had three seniors who taught all the classes. Now, they would meet with me throughout the week and we would prep it. But I mean, so then what they're doing is they're inviting their friends. They're like, hey, I'm teaching a Bible study at my friend's house. Do you want to come? And then we hang out and we play games. And like, again, when you're a part of something, you almost want to talk to people about what you're doing. And so that's something that I personally have done. Well, I think we also have had parents who have trained their kids up in the fear and the admonition of the Lord, who have taught them about who God is and about loving God and sharing God with other people. But, you know, and in a lot of ways, I had to see that in other families, because I wasn't so much seeing that at home. But I realized that, like, we have kids, we have stronger kids, we have weaker kids. The kids who are stronger kids have stronger parents who share the gospel and share their homes and share their time with other people. If you think kids don't see that, you're being naive at best. And so, I mean, like, how do you create that evangelism culture with teens? Create it at home where they see it, and then have other people who reinforce it, and then expect them to do it.
Bill, I just want to thank you for really a jolt in the arm here. I mean, it's super encouraging. I do want to, you know, find out who to actually talk to at Embry Hills that knows some things.
Anybody else is the right answer.
I know from my standpoint, and I think just based on the comments, that, you know, this has been really helpful and encouraging. Before we go, though, and first I'm going to start with this, Christina. I see you're on here. Is Luke with you? Because I'm going to get him to lead the closing prayer here in a minute. Can you chime in and let me know, is Luke Hurd actually participating in this right now?
Yeah, we're both here.
All right. In a minute here, I need you to lead us in a closing prayer. many here that are on this know Kerry Keenan. Bill, it's baseball season. I need you to give me the Kerry Keenan calls Bill Sanchez, come
hey,
down
Bill.
For a game.
Hey, Bill, I'm going to tell you.
Because the Red Sox just swept the Rays. By the way, the Red Sox are the first place Red Sox, let me just say. Just swept the Rays a few days ago. And so I texted him and Brent Lewis, who also lives in Florida, about it. And I was like, hey, boys, so how are we doing this week? And his text message is, a squirrel finds a nut every now and then. So that's my Kerry Keenan voice. That's just how I imagine he said it to me. But I'd say, like, I've talked to Josh about this. I'm not sure there's a person that I respect and look up to the way that I do Kerry Keenan because of the heart that he has for evangelism. And he's like, Bill, you got to preach the word, brother.
Well, you're doing that
at some point. I love you. I'm sorry. Whatever.
All that stuff. You're definitely doing that. And we're appreciative. Real quick, any of the elders have anything you want to add here at the end? All right. I have a feeling there's a baby waiting for Bill, because Bill's been on Zoom for about 2 hours now.
That is correct.
So, Luke, why don't you go ahead and lead us in a closing prayer? And Bill, again, from all of us, thank you so much for doing this for us. I think it was great. You know, whether or not you wanted to be interviewed or not, I think you really hit on some things we needed to hear. Luke, go ahead.
All right, let's pray. Lord, our God and our Father in heaven, we are so thankful for days like these, for evenings like these, that we can gather together to be of one heart and one mind to learn about you. Lord, there are so many great people in this world that we can be encouraged by, people like Bill who are doing your work and who can be shining lights for us. Lord, we are so thankful that your word has been passed down in the way that it has been passed down, that we can always learn from it, that your word can work in the hearts of people. The more that we spread it, the more that it will have an impact on this world. Lord, please help for us to be able to go out into the world and to be courageous, to be armed with your word, to be able to speak with others about what we know is true. Lord, if we do not wholeheartedly believe that your word is true, let our faith be strengthened in that matter. Help for us to take action for our own faith so that we can encourage the faith of others, so that we can be the shining lights that we are meant to be. Lord, we are thankful for this day of worship that we have been able to take part in, that we can gather together and give you the praise and the honor and the glory that you deserve. Lord, that we can recognize all that you have done in our lives, all that you will continue to do, to continue to provide us with grace and forgiveness and love that is overflowing in our lives. Lord, help us to be pricked in the heart by the things that have been spoken tonight, to realize that we have a calling that is much greater than we can imagine, that for us to go out into the world with new vigor, with new zeal, to let our light shine to everyone. Lord, thank you for the elders for putting this study together. Thank you for Bill for the wisdom and the path that you have put him on. Thank you for the encouragement that we have all experienced tonight. Lord, I ask that you will watch over those who have been away from us. Please keep everyone safe from any kind of sickness, any kind of accidents. Lord, please bring us all together at the next appointed time. Lord, we pray all these things in your Son's holy and amazing name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you again, brother. Thanks, everybody, for Thanks listening. For God bless you all.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you, Emily, for being here, even though I kept looking at that shirt and I was like, oh no.
Well, it's just my warm sweatshirt. I'm really a Rays fan.
That's not bad.
And just to make you like it a little bit more, my son is married to Annabelle.
Oh yeah. Okay.